Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everyone. I am Ben Johnson, and this is the Perpetual Chess Podcast. Perpetual Chess is a weekly chess interview show with accomplished chess players, authors, personalities, and adult improvers where they discuss their lives, their careers, and share tips about how to improve at chess. For more information, go to perpetualchesspod.com. So without further ado, let's get to the show. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Perpetual Chess, Chess Books Recaptured. For the uninitiated, of course, this is a monthly chess book review slash recap, where instead of just interviewing someone, we read a book and then get together to discuss it, try to give you a few chess takeaways, maybe increase your chess culture and history knowledge, and help you decide if a book is worthwhile. And this month, we will be talking about another super old chess book, another classic. It's called Chess Fundamentals by Jose Raul Capablanca, former world champion. And helping out this month, graciously, is Jesse Shikari. And so before we welcome Jesse, just a tiny bit of background. She's relatively new to chess, got into it in Queen's Gambit, but she's been active on chess Twitter and social media, being a big part of the community, contributing a lot. You can hear about her background on the Chess Journeys podcast. Shout out to the Chess Journeys podcast, where she goes deep into how she got into chess, and she's doing some sort of web design consultation related to the chess world as well. And I'm sure she's got a few more things she can tell us as we welcome her to the show. So Jesse, thanks again for helping out this month.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
Yeah, so we've got a lot to talk about with the Capa book. But first, let's just get any more biography that people should know. So you discovered, and again, there's more depth in other interviews you've done that people can find, but you discovered chess through Queen's Gambit, and then you discovered the world, basically. You knew the game, you discovered the world. And what's your experience been like with chess books, Jesse?
Oh, gosh. So my favorite pastime is reading. So I was super excited to discover that there were so many chess books, and then quickly realized I cannot read this. This is not in English or like understandable, like to sit and read, right? And so that became this like push and pull of like, more chess books, I can't read these. And like, I keep acquiring them, but my knowledge is not, it's like a big gap. So I haven't actually finished. This is like the first chess book I've finished that's not a tactics book. So this has been a really interesting like journey to go through. And I will preface by saying that I did read this book with my coach, my chess coach, because otherwise I would have a really difficult time reading this on my own.
Okay. Yeah. And definitely, as you say, a lot of bibliophiles in the chess world, although of course in the modern age, there's many other ways to learn chess. And I know that you're using a lot of online tools as well, as we can discuss. But we actually have a related question from friend of the podcast, Chris Wainscott, friend and supporter, Patreon supporter of the pod. So we might as well dive into that right away. So Chris asks Jesse, he says, as a newer devotee to chess, how do you decide what book you should read next? Also, how do you go through the book? Are you playing guess the move? Do you go through all the analysis, etc.? And Jesse, before we answer Chris's question, you might just want to give like whatever online rating, just to give people a bit of context. I mean, obviously, we know you're new to chess, so we could discern from that you haven't earned your grandmaster title just yet.
No, I'm so Lee Chess, I'm like a classical 800-ish on the border of 7 to 8, and then Rapid, I'm like a 700 somewhere in there. So yeah, I am definitely, you know, below 1,000 for sure. And so I'm still going on this journey and asking questions and learning as much as possible. But it's been a really interesting experience to learn this as an adult.
Yeah. Yeah. And we'll talk more about sort of how your being relatively new to chess landed with the Capablanca book in particular. But first, let's dive into Chris's questions. So, you know, you've been casting about for a book basically that's like proper for someone knows what checkmate is, knows the rules of the game, but doesn't have much of a chess background beyond that. And I know you've bought way, as all of us chess players do, you've bought way more chess books than one can read or one should read based on your experience level. But so in your sort of fits and starts, and this being the first book that you finished, what has your approach been? Do you try to guess the move? And do you go through the variations and stuff like that?
Yeah, so I will try to follow it like part by part and make sure that I understand it. Something that I'm still doing, and I guess this is more like training wheels for like learning of writing in my book. So I write out each variation and write like number them on the board or around the board so I can make sure that I follow along so I can look back at it and go understand exactly what that is. Although I'm trying to stop doing that because I need to be able to do this in my head. So when we worked on this book, like half of it I wrote in the book, and the other half because I was reaching a point where I needed to not do that and start like actually being able to read it. So I did that, and then I try to just make sure I understand like the main points. And how do I apply this stuff? What is, I'm still learning like what I need to know against like, this will be good for later, or this will be something important to come back to because not everything is going to be relevant initially. And how do I learn how to bank certain information for when they actually do show up in a game? That's definitely been a hard thing for me to understand of like, when is this actually important and how do I maintain that, right? So when we talk about playing the like the guess the move, I do that, but then I also have to think about like how do I store that information for like when I need it.
Yeah, and I'm sure it's not helped by, we were talking in one of our sort of brainstorming sessions leading up to this, the fact that there just aren't that many books for adults for people rated below 1,000. So I think that the challenge is increased by the fact that a lot of the books that end up getting recommended to you like are going to be challenging. And this book fits into that category, as we'll discuss, even though they're ostensibly beginner books. They're not truly, there's always this sort of assumption that one just magically has sort of a facility with the notation. And this book in particular, as we'll discuss, it's useful for a very broad range of rating, but I would say that's more of a detriment than a compliment in this case. Before we talk a bit more about the book, we had one other Patreon mailbag question that I thought would be good to address right away, and this one is more for me. So Jesse, if you're ready, maybe you could read the question from Mil Beso. I hope I said your name right, Mil. I probably didn't.
Sure. So when you do the book podcast, it'd be interesting if you could spend a few minutes on how you study games in books. I know you've covered this in some interviews in the past, but it's always interesting to hear about.
Okay. Yeah. And I do think that's a good question. And first of all, I got to give a shout out to the How to Chess podcast. We had Grandmaster Davorin Kolyasevich, who wrote a book about choosing your own study plans. And that was the topic we discussed, a grandmaster's advice for how to go through a game. Now, I'm only a washed up master, but I can try to give my advice as well. And the main thing is, and this comes up a lot on the podcast, is just you always want to be favoring active learning over passive learning. So like what Chris Wainscott asked about playing Guess the Move, like that's a great way to do it. Some people will even cover up the following move on their sheet. Like they'll have a piece of paper covering the following move and just try to guess the move, try to engage with the material. I mean, often you're not going to understand why a move is made, and you want to try to figure it out on your own. And then maybe from there, turn on an engine if you're using a computer to read the book. So basically, you want to try to avoid just sort of mindlessly playing through the moves. And that's kind of the main advice I could give. Depth over breadth, especially as you're newer to chess, as you get more experienced and like you're trying to see like where people put their pieces and stuff like that. If you're trying to learn an opening, then it can be helpful to just go through a quantity of games. But if you're like a club player, it's better to try to understand as many moves as possible. And of course, that's why I often find myself recommending the books with lots of annotations. And we'll have more on that topic later, but I wanted to bring it forward to what we need to know about the context of chess fundamentals before we actually assess the book. So first published in 1921, Capablanca became world champion shortly thereafter. He was in, when this book was published, he was in the middle of an 8-year, 63 tournament game unbeaten streak. So just staggering streak. And he's one of my favorite players of all time. Botvinnik had a nice quote explaining sort of what it is that's so appealing about the way that Capablanca played. He said, "Capablanca's play produced and still produces an irresistible artistic effect. In his games, a tendency towards simplicity dominated. And in this simplicity, there was a unique beauty of genuine depth." And that's what everyone basically says about Capablanca. And if you play through a bunch of his games, it really comes across. He's just a natural genius. He's not like this tactical wizard. I mean, all world champions are amazing tactically, but what he's best known for is just this sort of light touch of knowing where the pieces go. And that's why, like, even if you're not able to calculate at a grandmaster level, there's a lot to be gained from going through his games. A lot of people consider him to be one of the best players of all time. And chess fundamentals, I don't think it's ever come up on Perpetual Chess and all the book recommendations I've gotten. So it is, it is a classic, but it's not like my system. People aren't like bringing it up like every single week. I feel like it's having a bit of a moment now, and we'll talk about why that is shortly. But I mean, there, you know, again, Botvinnik had a quote about it. He said, "It's without question still timely and has value to players of all levels." He said that in 1984. And I mean, I'm sure if he were alive, he would be saying the same thing now. And, you know, Nick DeFermian, who wrote a version he updated a version for McKay Publishing about 15 years ago. And he wrote in his introduction that there's always something to learn from this book. He said it was absolutely the most instructive chess book that existed for half a century after it was written. That might be true, because that's an important qualifier, right, Jesse? So we might as well, I mean, we'll give a little more background information, but what was your impression? Let's start with the readability of the book, Jesse.
Readability, interesting. So I guess I would say, I mean, it's obviously, you know, written 100 years ago, so readability wise, it's definitely a little different, but I did find that, you know, it took a little bit of time for me to understand what exactly he was like trying to tell me to do, right? And then once I understood it and like actually made those moves, oh, okay, I see what he's trying to say. But also sometimes I was just like, why isn't this a little more succinct? There should be simpler ways to be able to say what you're saying, right? So that was kind of a maybe just a difference of a modern reader approaching a book that's, you know, a classic.
Yeah. Yeah. And I agree. I mean, as someone who recently read and reviewed My System, it's way more readable than my system, I will say. but those of you who heard my recap with I Am Christoph Zalecki, that's not saying all that much. So it's readable in that respect, but I definitely have some qualms with this sort of the expository style of the book. I mean, there's just, it's a little bit scattershot what is explained and what isn't. That's something we'll be getting into a bit more, obviously, but just a few general points. This is another book that's in the public domain. So it's similar to My System. There's versions absolutely everywhere. I mentioned the McKay version, which is not that beloved online. Everyman Chess did a nice job on their version of the book. There's a lot of sort of fly-by-night publisher books, so be careful what you buy on Amazon. And then, of course, we got to give a shout-out to Martin Eustason, Say Chess. And part of the reason I was mentioning that the book is having a moment is he just came out with his own edition. Of course, he's been on the podcast. He wrote these blindfold puzzle books that are really good. And he reproduced it in sort of the way I think that a lot of people newer to chess would like very, very healthy use of diagrams, and really big text, clear prose. So he didn't alter the content of the book, to his credit, but he made it nice and presentable and very pleasant to read. And he sent one to both of us. So again, shout out to Martin. So our review of the book itself, I think, is going to be kind of lukewarm. But if you do buy it, if you do buy it, definitely, I think Martin's book is the way to go. I think Everyman Chess might have an e-reader if you prefer to read on computers. And the other thing is, again, because it's in the public domain, even Lee Chess Studies has the book in three different parts. So obviously, again, if you're going to buy it, we recommend Martin's. But if you're on a budget or would rather read on a computer, you don't even need to buy it. You can just play through it on Lee Chess's study. And when you play through it on Lee Chess's study, you can't have the computer on because of the kind person who created it had computers disabled. But if you clone the study to make it your own, you can then put the engine on. So if you're sort of struggling with the material, that can be a good way to check with the engine. So Jesse, I know that you've described yourself as an old school book reader. So I'm guessing you mostly use the Martin's copy for this?
Yeah. So I actually had one of those fly by night Amazon editions at first, and it was too small. Everything was cramped in, and because I write all over my books, there wasn't any space for me to do this stuff. So when Martin was like, oh, I'm sending this book, I was like, oh, cool. And then it showed up, and I was just like, oh my God, there's space to write and make notes and be able to see the board without it being too, like, I could just see it without doing too much. So when I talked about how I add the variations onto diagram, I actually had the space to do that. And I didn't have to like take notes on a notebook or something, because I'm really tactile, so I have to just write everything down. So I was just so happy that this edition has the space to be able to sort of study it.
Yeah, Martin did a great job, and I think he's charging $10 for the book, which is a steal. I mean, you know, qualms with the book notwithstanding, you can certainly get $10 worth of reading material for it. I should have checked this before, but I'm going to take a quick look on the price. There it is. Sponsored content, Martin, with the ad going on Amazon. Yeah, $9.75. So anyway, we're going to actually talk about the structure of the book and what even more about what we think of the book. But first, let's take a break and hear from our sponsors. Perpetual Chess is brought to you in part by our longtime sponsors, our original sponsors, Chessable.com. Chessable, of course, is known for its proprietary move trainer technology, which utilizes spaced repetition to help you remember openings, tactical patterns, whatever it is that you're working on. They have a huge library of courses, including the free, short, and sweet versions of various openings. Speaking of openings, they just dropped Lifetime Repertoires, The London System by Grandmaster Lequang Liam. Love or hate The London, you got to know what to do against it, so be sure to take a look for that. And don't forget to sub to the How To Chess podcast, hosted by yours truly. We just had Peter Sfidler on, other big guests in the works. So all the links you need are in the show description. Let's get back to talking chess.
If you're an athlete, you know the greatest motivator of all is the fear of letting your teammates down. After all, a team is only as good as its weakest link. So you owe it to those wearing the same jersey as you to be your best every time you step on the field. That's why there's no vape in team. When you vape, you can expose your lungs to toxic chemicals that can damage your lungs. If you're a step behind, the team's a step behind. Brought to you by The Real Cost and the FDA.
And we are back, and I did verify the price, and it's under $10 for Martin's version, so definitely a bargain if you're going to buy it. We also forgot to mention for whom this book is most appropriate. Again, that's kind of a loaded question, but a friend of the pod, Jostein Langstrand, whose book reviews I always enjoy, Potzer's Review, he guessed 1,200 to 1,600. He recently wrote a review of Chess Fundamentals that I'll link to. I agree on the 1200, as Jesse, I think, will help us illustrate. It's not, despite its title, for brand new players. But on the high end, I would go even higher than 1600. I mean, you know, this is a world champion explaining his moves, and he's often not sugarcoating things. So I think at least, like, it might even go up to 2000. And again, as we were saying earlier, that's not necessarily a great thing if, you know, if you're serving too many masters. It's not serving anyone perfectly. But anyway, the structure of the book, you know, Capablanca, of course, famous, especially for his endgame play, had an incredible ability to extract wins from tiny advantages and make it look easy. And that was sort of his philosophy of chess. He was known for not being like a big opening theoretician, even in those days where openings were not as advanced. He kind of had a disdain for studying openings. And he wrote, and studying chess generally as a world champion, he was known as this sort of natural genius who didn't work as hard at the board as many of the, or away from the board as most of the world champions. So Capablanca, I relied for some background material. Edward Winter, famed, awesome chess historian, has a great book about Capablanca. So I got a few background quotes from that. And he said, "I began with the ending as that is the proper place to start." And sure enough, he does begin with endgame and basic checkmates from the beginning. But we'll talk, and the chapters are first principles, which is endgame, further principles, which is endgame, planning a win in middle game play, which is middle game, general theory, again, kind of middle game, endgame strategy, further openings in middle games, and then finally 14 illustrative games. So kind of, and it's a little bit scattershot. And again, in reading Edward Winter's book, some of the material I think was culled from like journal entries that he'd written, again, similar to my system. So that might contribute to there not being a sort of unifying theme in the book, as again, we'll discuss. But first, we have a great big block quote that I pulled from the Winter book, a speech that that Capablanca gave in 1932, which is about the book, but also about his philosophy of chess. Here is the quote. Capablanca said, "Anyone wishing to progress in chess must consider the game as a whole that may be divided into three parts. The first phase, to which the majority of people devote the most time and study, is the opening. The second is called the middle game, which comes immediately after the opening. This is studied less than the opening, and it may be the least studied phase of the game. Lastly, there is the end game, which is also not studied with the same intention and devotion as are the openings. 11 years ago, I wrote a book, and instead of starting, as all books do, with the opening, I began with the ending, believing that this was the proper place to start. You will readily understand that it is much easier to handle one or two pieces than all the pieces together. Moreover, it's a curious but true fact that no player becomes world champion or even a contender for the title unless you give serious attention to the end game." And then he goes on to talk about the sort of well-known problem of if you just remember an opening but don't understand it, you won't know what to do. Obviously, that's a struggle that carries on to this day. So I think it's a, you know, I like the philosophy, and I like that even amongst the world champions, there's such different approaches to chess and chess improvement. And even the idea of putting the end game first, I think is pretty cool. But the choice of the end games is a bit odd. Jesse, why don't you take us through your experience, like right from the beginning of where he starts with the rook and king checkmate as the very first thing he presents in the book.
Yeah. So when we started there, and once I sort of got the hang of what he was trying to say, I was like, oh, this is easy for me, right? Like, so I'm excited because I'm like, oh, cool. Like, I am not going to be completely behind right from the outset. So I was ready. I was like, yeah, okay, cool. So I recognized some of these things I've already learned as a beginner. And then that pretty much changed not too long after. And I started falling behind.
Yeah. And it's a big jump, like the rook and king checkmate he does at the beginning, the two bishops checkmate. And then in very short order, he's doing some king and pawn endgames, which start basic, but it escalates quickly. And I think that's sort of the general issue with this book. And it's common that when you're the best player in the world, you're not like every time, you know, I've been lucky to interview Peter Svidler a few times, and he's very self-aware and always says, like, I'm the worst teacher in the world, because he knows that as a, and of course it's not true in his case, but he knows that as a world-class player, a lot of things seem second nature to him. And Capablanca often has very incisive explanations, but again, the things he chooses to explain are kind of, it's hard to predict. And certainly it doesn't seem like, at the beginning with the rook and king checkmate, I feel like it's very thorough. And if you didn't know how to do it when you were reading it, you actually could learn from the book. But then in the more advanced stuff, it's actually less thorough. And the other thing is, again, it's just like, who are you serving? You know, if you've got rook and king checkmate at the beginning and like grandmaster battles at the end with sparse annotations, like who is your target audience? And, you know, again, this book was written 100 years ago. So of course there just might not have been as much planning. People would have been happy to get any book by a world champion. So, within the context of when it was published, I'm sure it was revolutionary, but it's just, he's got to compete with these good modern books. And of course, we'll have some alternative recommendations later. Now, I do want to be clear, there is amazing stuff sprinkled throughout. It's just, again, it's not entirely clear who the target audience is and how the material was, like how the layout other than the endgame first principle was designed.
Yeah, I would agree. I when I first opened the book and I looked at the table of contents, I was like, I don't know what am I going to learn from this? Because it's not clear. Even though we talk about like general theory as part of like the middle game, but at the same time, it doesn't say middle game, right? It just says, you know, when you look at the table of contents, it tells you, you know, if it's going to be opening, middle, or end game. And so there's like 3 different chapters on middle game, yeah. But it's in the beginning, the middle, and the end of the book. And so I was just like, I already don't know what I'm supposed to take away from this. And I found that a little concerning. And to me, it would have made sense to have the general theory at the beginning of the book, because, you know, you want to cement, like, here's what you're going to learn, right? And then you're going to see it played out across these games and these examples. Once I sort of hit the point past like the pawn promotions and things like that, I did start learning new stuff. The blocked position, some of the like the part about the knight versus the bishop. Like, I also thought that the knight was more important than a bishop because it can do more, but then I realized he was right, that like, oh, a bishop is like a stronger piece than a knight. Okay, that's that. I just learned something new. Good. But at the same time, by the time I got there, all those, like, I can only calculate about 2 to 3 moves ahead. And that's about it. Anything more than that, it's not easy for me. So the fact that after a little while, things get like go off the deep end, I was like, whoa. And while I was working on this with my coach, he had to help me like through some of this stuff. He was like, okay, like, I know you're not gonna be able to see what he's trying to tell you, so here, let me help you a little and like give you a little foundation, and then you can do like the core point of any particular example. And I was like, this, like, part of me was wondering, like, did the word fundamentals change over 100 years?
Right, yeah.
This is not fundamentals if you know, I have to get like a boost to understand what he's trying to tell me, and then it becomes kind of counterintuitive, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and there's a lot of that. And what you say about the relative value of the pieces is a good observation. Another quote from Capablanca from the Edward Winter book. Capa said, "What will come as a shock to most players will be the relative value of bishop and knight in the endgame. Contrary to popular belief, the bishop is the stronger piece. In the last 20 years, chess has made enormous strides, and many of the old masters are proven wrong on this point." And he also said, "I challenge anyone to produce a work of such accuracy on first appearance." And I think both of those are amazing points, and it is important to sort of remember how far ahead of his time he was. And even in terms of the accuracy, like, Jesse, I know you had mentioned in our brainstorming, that you were curious, like, how it holds up to sort of modern analysis. And first of all, like, I should say, like, left to my own devices, I would not be remotely qualified to critique the accuracy of Capablanca's moves, but I did look through it with an engine, with the Lee Chess web engine, since I was able to so easily on the Lee Chess study, and it is remarkably accurate. I mean, there's one game where, like, you know, it goes from equal to -6 on one mistake that he makes, and he doesn't even give that move a note. And you know, there's only 14 games, so, like, if you're not sort of asked to what Jesse was saying, he's not doing an amazing job, like, highlighting the critical moments. But again, there are some very good explanations, and his analysis often was very accurate, and notably accurate, even in errors notwithstanding, compared to other books. So again, it's a mixed bag. And one other thing I wanted to add on the basic mates thing, even though he does an amazing job explaining these basic mates, they're, I think, uniquely suited to learning on computer. If you want to learn a rook and king checkmate, I mean, Lee Chess and chess.com and Chessable, and they all have drills you can do. And to practice those against a computer is just, like, you know, it's an amazing opportunity. You know, when I was a kid, you needed a person. And if you didn't have a person, like, you had to try to learn it from a book. But now there's clearly, for repeating a specific sequence to end a game, there's nothing better than practicing against a computer. So even the part that's, like, explained well, it's not necessarily, like, the right place for it. So again, there are some great observations you will definitely learn from the book. But yeah, it's disjointed, I guess you could say.
Yeah, that's the thing. Like, there's that part of, like, the relative value of the pieces, where it's like a whole page of, like, you know, the bishop will be stronger than the pawns than the knight. And I was like, I don't know what that means. And so my coach and I had to go line by line every single, and I had to, you know, so that part of the book is actually written up with, like, this is for attacking, this is for, you know.
Yeah, let me actually read a few of them. We won't read them all, but just to give listeners a bit more context. So yeah, he was big on comparing the relative value of the pieces. And he says, for all general theoretical purposes, the bishop and the knight have to be considered as the same value, though it is my opinion that the bishop will prove the more valuable piece in most cases. And it is well known that two bishops are almost always better than two knights. So, okay, that comment obviously has aged well. The bishop will be stronger against pawns than the knight, and in combination with pawns will also be stronger against the rook than the knight will be. So as to what Jesse's saying already, you got to read that one a few times to try to understand. And then it goes on like that. A bishop and rook are also stronger than a knight and rook, but a queen and knight may also be stronger than a queen and a bishop. And that's one that you do hear a lot of grandmasters say that. Although John Watson, when he wrote Secrets of Modern Chess Strategy, did, like, a big data dive of, like, analyzing, isolating endgames where you have a queen and knight and a queen and bishop. And what he found, there was no sort of empirical proof that a queen and knight is better than a queen and a bishop, but it's at least, like, it's more of a fair fight. You know, you can attack on both color complexes, whereas with a queen and a bishop, that's more challenging. A bishop will often be worth more than three pawns, but a knight very seldom so, and may not even be worth so much. A rook will be worth a knight and two pawns, or a bishop and two pawns. But as we said before, the bishop will be a better piece against the rook. And then there's, like, two more of them. And I can totally see, Jesse, how that could be, like, 3 hours of lessons just trying to deconstruct, like, what it is he's saying in that, like, little paragraph.
Yeah. And even the one of, like, you know, a bishop will often be worth more than three pawns, but a knight very seldom so, and may not be worth so much. Like, I mean, is there, like, what is that still true? Like, is it just, like, a context specific situation of, like, it depends, you know?
Yeah. I mean, in most cases, you're definitely going to prefer a bishop, but I wouldn't, yeah, I hadn't thought of it in the formulation of a knight just isn't going to be as good as three pawns. I think it's very context specific.
Okay. Yep. See, that's what I mean. Like, I wouldn't know that as a beginner, And so like, for example, the first part of, you know, talking about the bishop will prove more valuable than like a knight. And then it's this, oh, an open position. Okay. Now I know that that's good for an open position, but I wouldn't have known that from reading it because there's no context.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that was something that really drove me nuts. He leaves a lot to the reader's devices to figure out what exactly he means. That's not helpful for a beginner.
Yeah. And I don't want to like put anyone on blast, Jesse, but do you remember like how was it that you decided this was the book to read? I mean, I know there's so many recommendations given in so many places, not least this podcast, that it can be hard to keep up. But do you remember how you settled on this book?
Multiple people told me to read this book.
Wow.
I don't know why.
Okay. I mean, and I hadn't read it previously. And again, there's some great moments in it and some great explanations, and the games really could keep you busy for a long time. I mean, 14 games, and the fact that six of them are games that he lost, that's very rare, and shows a sort of humility and, you know, dedication to learning from his own losses. I think that's quite admirable. And it was rare, especially at that time, but it's a lot of work to study on one's own. You know, maybe it's optimal. Maybe it's a good way to study. Maybe it's not.
Yeah.
I mean, and generally, sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, he does that whole thing of like, you know, the reader can figure out what they need to know from this. And I was like, you can't do this to me. Because it says, he even says like, you know, the book is only a guide. And it's really up to the learner to figure out what they need. And if they have a teacher, then that's best. But not everybody has a coach. And so, you know, I don't know what the context of like, you know, players in the 1920s might have had, but you would think that he would dole out more of his insight to particular components rather than being like, this game resigns and the reader will understand why. I don't.
Yeah. Yeah. And he's got like, you know, 30 pages after he's teaching you how a king and rook mate, he has literally a 10 move combination that he's showing. Yeah. And it's a cool combination, and it's fairly linear. You know, it's not a lot of sort of variations, but still, like, the idea that someone new to chess, someone that didn't know the king and rook checkmate, is then going to be like learning a 10 move combination, like, you know, the material is wrong for one of the people. Like, either it's for someone who didn't need the king and rook mate, or the rest of the book is too advanced, which was the case for Jesse. And again, it's not your fault at all. but that's just what ended up happening. But I mean, his endgame stuff, I do want to say it's brilliant. If you are, say, I would say 1400-1500 USCF, and you're looking to improve your endgame, playing through his endgame sections, his explanations of how to convert an advantage. He's got some nice sort of examples of what we now call the principle of two weaknesses, which we didn't call then. He has like a two, the one that holds two, where there's like a pawn duo on one side and against one pawn, but the one pawn is able to stop the two pawns. He's got lots of good examples and decent explanation, although generally it averages maybe an annotation every five moves or something like that.
Which I found not helpful.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, the sort of broader, well, first of all, I mean, again, when this was written, I think people were just so glad to have a chess book. I mean, it was just such a different age that things have changed a lot, and that they weren't competing with, you know, John Bartholomew's Chess Fundamentals series, which is on YouTube, which is a good alternative. Jesse and I will pick up this conversation in a minute, but first we're going to take a break and hear from our sponsors. Perpetual Chess is brought to you in part by chessmood.com. Chessmood is a subscription-based instructional website founded by Grandmaster Avtech Gregorian, who you can hear on episode 192 of Perpetual Chess. Founded by Avtech and his team of grandmasters, there's a huge library of opening, middle game, and end game videos. There's special events like webinars, streams, one-on-one blitz games. Every Chess Mood member gets a consultation call with one of the Grandmaster coaches. And also be sure to check out Chess Mood's free content. Avtech has a great blog. They also have a YouTube channel where they're posting videos from Grandmasters daily. So links you need are in the show description, but be sure to check out chessmood.com. Perpetual Chess is brought to you in part by aimchess.com. AimChess, of course, collects your games from the major chess sites and then gives you an actionable study plan. So it's a great resource for players and coaches alike. It tells you how you compare to your rating peers in openings, end games, time management, all that stuff. It told me I was behind on the clock in 87% of my recent blitz games. I think I might need to work on that. And thanks to AimChess for pointing that out. But it's a great product. Go to AimChess and check it out. And if you decide to try out a subscription, use the code PERPETUAL30 to save 30%. As always, the info you need is also in the show notes.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
I reached out to a friend of the podcast, Fred Wilson, just to sort of, you know, Fred knows his chess history like no other. So I was curious, I had asked him about some of the different editions of the book, but also just sort of his opinion, because I always feel a little bad, you know, being sort of like, you know, club level, decent club level player, weak master, whatever, criticizing the works of these legends. It feels a little odd, but on the other hand, it's very hard deciding what to devote your time to. And I just feel like there are better choices. So anyway, I asked Fred what he thought, and I have a quote from Fred of Fred Wilson Books in Union Square in New York City, the only chess bookstore in New York City. So if you're in it, check out Fred's store. You can also hear an interview I did with Fred for Perpetual Chess. And of course, patrons of the show used to be able to hear his old interview show, which had some gems as well. So anyway, here's what Fred said. Finally, back in the dark ages, we fought our way through the classics, trying to understand them because we really wanted to get better. If you didn't, you remained a potzer, though perhaps with some tactical talent, you could beat your equally lazy friends. Someone once wrote that until you realize that chess is not just a random series of tactical opportunities, you will never really become a good player. So pushing through Kappa's notes to six of his serious losses should always be helpful. So, and I think that's kind of what it comes down to is like, how useful is it to sort of torture yourself for explanations that aren't there, that aren't provided, I should say. The truth is in there, and that's how people used to learn, but that's because there was no choice. So, yeah. And I'm not a neuroscientist. I can only guess, but it seems to me like it's probably not the optimal use of one's time. I mean, do you have other books? I know you said you didn't finish any other prose books, Jesse, but have you come across some where you were reading and you're like, this is more like it?
Ooh, that's an interesting question. I'm just going to peek over at my bookshelf for a minute.
Okay. And if you want, Jesse, I could give a few of my counter recommendations while you do
sure.
That. Okay. So regular listeners aren't going to be surprised by most of my recommendations. I tend to repeat myself. But one that I haven't mentioned that much is Patrick Wolf, Grandmaster Patrick Wolf, who's been on the show. It used to be called The Complete Idiot's Guide to Chess, but now I believe it's called Learn to Play Chess Like a Boss. I picked up the new version because I was thinking for Jesse, you know, first. I was thinking for someone like Jesse, brand new to chess, but doesn't want to read a kid's book, like, what should they read? And Patrick does a great job, and he starts even more basic than the King and Rook. I mean, I believe he starts with how the pieces move, but it's sort of presented in a much more logical. He introduces you to all the basic tactics, then he introduces you to some basic strategic concepts, and does a really good job explaining things. So if you're like your first chess book after you know what checkmate is, I think that's a great choice. And then as you advance from there, to probably what Jesse's level is now and towards sort of like a 1000 USCF FIDE. That's where the recommendations get a little bit more familiar. They've definitely been mentioned before on the show. You know, Neil Bruce, shout out to Neil, always recommends First Book of Morphe. And I was getting tired of repeating his recommendation without checking it out myself. So I ordered it and checked it out. And I totally see how it could be super helpful, because unlike this book, it has many, many annotations. And as Peter Giannatos recently talked about on the pod, when you go back in time to like the era of Morphe, where he was just thrashing his opponents, you know, there's more to learn from that than like, you know, these Capablanca Marshall games that came, you know, some decades later, because it was a much fairer fight. Whereas Morphe was just so far ahead of his peers that you can really learn from the more basic mistakes that people will counter. And you don't have to do all the hard work of figuring out your explanations on your own. And then, of course, for Capablanca himself, there's Irving Chernev's Capablanca's Endgame book, which, again, is more advanced. I mean, that's probably, again, 1400 on up. But there's Logical Chess Move by Move by Chernev. Did a podcast about it. So there are good choices. And, you know, in another exchange with Fred, he was saying, like, and there's always Jeremy Silman. There's lots of explanations. And Fred brought up a point that maybe some people don't like to be spoon-fed. They might feel like it's too much. Jesse, do you think it's possible to have, like, too many annotations in a chess book coming from your perspective?
No, never enough. I need to know exactly what people are thinking. And then, you know, so I understand, right? I need the context. And I think that's part of the problem of it's not spoon fed. And so depending on what kind of person you are, it could either be a challenge of like, oh, you're not going to spoon feed this to me, so I'm going to figure it out. Or it's just too open ended and you're just going to get bored and skip.
Yeah. And that's sort of how I feel too. Now, I've been reading this book called Make It Stick. When I interviewed Dr. Christopher Chabri, he recommended it as sort of a good guide to the science of learning and sort of like how we remember things. And they had a quote that resonated with me as I was sort of grappling with these questions while reading this book, which is, it's not that the failure, so they're talking about not understanding something. It's not that the failure that's desirable, it's the dauntless effort, despite the risks, the discovery of what works and what doesn't, that sometimes only failure can reveal. It's trusting that trying to solve a puzzle is better than being spoon-fed the solution, even if we fall short in our first attempts at an answer. As we said earlier, the process of trying to solve a problem without the benefit of being taught is called generative learning. So, you know, the basic point they're making, obviously, and this is something, again, that comes up when grandmasters sort of preach against just memorizing moves in the opening. They're like, Grandmaster Ganguly, when I interviewed him, said it's a sin. You have to understand every move that you're memorizing, even if it requires a lot of work. And, you know, again, I wouldn't be qualified to disagree with these neuroscientists anyway, but it rang true to me in terms of how people learn chess. And Avchak Gregorian recently wrote a blog post about sort of how grandmasters remember openings better because they know context better. And I think that's true, but that doesn't mean that this is the book that you should be like spending 12 hours deconstructing, right? Like, because again, it was written at a time when like, you might not even have anyone to play. You know, you might just be in your house. You don't have anyone to play. You're looking to learn chess, and this is the one book you have. So in that case, okay, it's better than nothing. But now you always have your own games to study. You know, you can play infinite of your own games and learn from those. So of course we need to learn from the masters as well. But I think those things come in time. You know, like if you're a newer player learning from Capablanca, you're going to need a lot of explanations, and you're going to need, honestly, like a sort of misrepresentative sample of his games. They can't be like the most advanced ones. Anyway, I feel like I'm kind of rambling, but it's an interesting topic.
Yeah, no, I agree. And the interesting thing about that quote that you just read about the falling short, I don't think it's good to have a challenge. It's just, can you actually meet that bar? And the one thing about chess that has been really interesting journey is the like high barrier of entry to actually get into it, where you're not constantly losing all the time, and you know, things like that. And so when I think the high barrier of entry makes it hard for new people to get into it. And so when you mesh the quote and this book together, it Kappa Blanca just feeds right into the high barrier of entry for new people, and that makes it difficult. But I agree that when you actually do meet that challenge and work through this stuff, you do learn it better. But at the same time, if it's not, there's not a lot of context, and I think context is one of the hardest things to understand about chess as a new person, because so much of it depends on your experience, right? The more experience you have, the better, like, the easier it becomes to address certain problems. But until you have that experience, it's very difficult to understand why something is important, or how to defend against particular things that might come up. So I agree, just a caveat of this book is not the best example of how to help yourself learn and meet that knowledge gap.
Yeah. And again, even for the players, I would say, for whom, like Jessie, again, it wasn't the best choice for her experience level. But if you are, say, 14, 1500 USCF or FIDE, I think it's a decent choice, but it will be hard work figuring out a lot of the moves, and it will be a bit uneven. The book's a pretty quick read. Like, you know, if you're not spending hours trying to sort of figure out what's underneath the surface in terms of the lack of annotations in some situations, I mean, you could read it in like 4 hours. You know, it's not a super long book. And I think for, say, 1400 to 1800, there's plenty of worthwhile material. But I think there's other good choices too. And again, just in terms of comparing calling a spade, even Chernev's Capablanca book, Capablanca's Best Chess Endings, I would prefer that to Capablanca's own words, which, I, again, it might be considered like blasphemous to some people who are like, you know, you have to read the world champions in their own words, you know. But I mean, most of the, you know, the audience are not going to be world champions. So it's I think better to be spoon-fed. I'm on team spoon-fed.
Me too. But I will say that there's something about reading a book that's not the most ideal book to start with. So like, it's good to read the classics, right? And understand why they're good, but also understand like why they're classics and why maybe it's not always the best choice, if that makes sense. So if you have a, like, for this book, I was like, okay, so I got some good information out of it. And there was some information that's too advanced for me. Okay, so we put that aside. And then what do I like? What don't I like? And I think that's a good way to still inform yourself about what you want out of a book moving forward. What are you looking for? You know, maybe not everybody likes, you know, classical, like, literature, for example. And it's the same thing. It's just, is this helpful? You know, did it advance my knowledge? Yes. So, like, quite simply, yes. But the caveat is, you know, there's a lot of other stuff that wasn't helpful. So it didn't balance out. And so I think it's also important to analyze as a reader, like, why this book was helpful. But the recommendation is definitely, like, this is good, but context, depending on what you want to get out of the book, or maybe just even particular chapters. Like, the first three chapters, I think, were the most helpful for me. And then once I started reading chapters 4, 5, and 6, or 4 and 5, I can't remember which one was the one with the game annotations, but, you know, what can you get out of it? I don't think there's anything wrong with picking up a book, only reading 2 or 3 chapters and then putting it down, because eventually I'll come back to this when I'm, you know, 1400 player, and this will make more sense, or things will just come to me faster, with time and experience.
Yeah. And again, the fact that Martin's only charging $10 for his book, and that you can read it for free online, without violating copyright laws, means that you, as Jessie said, you don't have to read the whole thing. You can pick and choose, and just playing through the games and seeing his notes is pleasant. Although, again, I mean, maybe I'm just, too much in favor of spoon feeding, but even with the games, I could have used a little bit more of, like, I lost because of this, you know. And at the end of each chapter, you know, these days, a lot of authors, I think, have figured out that people like review puzzles, they like bullet points, sort of summarizing. And there's, you know, this is a 100-year-old book. And you've got to be careful if you're going to mess with the original text. You know, Nick DeFermi, in the version he did for McKay, he added some modern games, including his own games. And like, even a grandmaster like Nick DeFermi, and like, not everyone liked that he did that. So it's sort of like, you know, damned if you do, damned if you don't, in terms of messing with the text. But I'm sure that someone could do sort of a modern, more expository treatment that used the original material in a better way. But yeah, I mean, overall, I'd still give the book a, you know, I think for someone Jesse's level, I'd give it like a D. But but for someone rated 1500, I would give it like a B, B minus, something like that. There's plenty of useful stuff. It's just, it's a little bit harder work than a lot of the chess learning that you need to do these days. So Jesse, can you think of anything concrete that you learned from this book? I'm putting you on the spot here, but I'm just curious as we start to wrap up.
Yeah. So I think some of the stuff that I think was good. So the rook king checkmate is now like muscle memory to me, which is good. The relative value actually was kind of helpful. I might have to just kind of keep going back to it the more I learn, just to make sure that I fully understand it. I think so. Something that's interesting to me about chess is that everything depends on context, and because this book completely lacks context, that's added an extra value of like the analytics of, do I actually understand what I'm learning? So the block position was really helpful, and it's actually stuff I've seen in like titled games where I've seen people do the like color, like I think Anish Giri moved all of his pieces off into white, all the white squares when he was playing Nepo once, and I was like, oh, that's what he did. I understand now. You know?
So like where one side was completely blocked, the pawn structure was locked, or what do you mean by the block position?
So yeah, that page. Let me see. Okay.
No worries.
Yeah. So the blocked position that I found interesting because it was something that I didn't understand very well. And so I found that really helpful of like understanding the role of the pawns and the bishops. So like, for example, pawn structure, I know what it is and that's about it. Yeah. So for me, I found that helpful. And then also just the idea of that Capablanca talks about how you can use the square, like the colored squares to your advantage, right? That is also something I understand in theory, but have not actually put into practice. But because he uses it, I found that helpful. Like, okay, here's a way that I could implement it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, just hearing you talk about it, I mean, it's pretty advanced, you know? He has some, and speaking of the structures, he has a couple sort of pawn skeleton positions. He really liked the French, where he talks about sort of where the pawn breaks are, similar to what Neil Bruce and I were discussing in the pawn pod, where, you know, you can sort of see it was probably one of the first examples of its kind where it's just isolating where the pawns are, as is done in chess structures and pawn structure chess and many other more modern books. So there is some great stuff in here, but it's just the batting average is not that high, and yeah, but bigger criticism is just the number of explanations. I mean, stuff that I'm sure seems second nature to him, his intended audience, does not seem second nature to what one would presume is the intended audience of a book called Chess Fundamentals.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting that the queen against rook area, it says this is one of the most difficult endings without pawn. Yeah. And I was like, why is this in here? Like,
yeah, and he does do a good job explaining sort of the bare essence, but again, and so it is useful for certain people. It's just, you've got to pick and choose. All right. I feel like we're kind of repeating ourselves. So we should wrap up. So Jesse, first of all, thank you. I also wanted to make a donation to a chess charity. on your behalf. I appreciate all this work that you've done. And what do you think, Jesse? Who should we support?
Let's do Chess in the Slums.
Okay. Shout out to Tunde and Aaron and the team at Chess in the Slums. Happy to support them. Again, you can hear my interview with them. They're doing amazing work in Nigeria and possibly beyond someday. So thank you, Jesse. And a couple housekeeping notes. We are going to do a throwback and do a blindfold chess puzzle or two blindfold chess puzzles at the end. There's been overwhelming demand. One or two people asked me to do them. So this is not going to resume to being a permanent feature, but this month we will do a couple. And next month, we're going to switch it up a little bit, do something slightly less instructive. I'm going to be catching up with an old friend, John Fernandez, who recently was elected to the U.S. Chess Board of Directors and has a successful career outside of chess, but he's always sort of stayed near the chess world, and he's got some great stories. And what the book we're going to discuss is Chess is My Life by Grandmaster Viktor Korchnoi. So we're going to read a biography. He does have 15 games in the book as well, so we'll be able to talk some chess strategy and chess improvement, as well as diving into sort of the amazing life experience of legendary Soviet and then former Soviet grandmaster. So that should be fun as well, coming hopefully in late October. So Jesse, thanks again. If people want to keep up with you, reach out, maybe study together or whatever it may be, what's the best way to keep up with you, Jesse?
You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Jesse Shakarian. Yeah, I would love to do like a chess punk study group. That would be super cool.
Awesome. Okay. So yeah, I'll link to that. And yeah, thank you again, Jesse, for suffering through this book that was a little bit too advanced for you.
No, it was fun. I enjoyed it.
Okay. Well, I'm glad to hear it, and I do appreciate it. So thank you, Jesse. And goodbye, everyone. Stay tuned if you want to hear the blindfold puzzles.
Thank you.
Hello there, blindfold chess wizards and aspiring blindfold chess wizards. We are back with the increasingly rare blindfold chess puzzle special feature on the Book Recap podcast. And this is a Stafford Gambit special edition. Shout out to I Am Eric Rosen. Both of these puzzles are taken from traps in the Stafford Gambit. Here we go with number one. So we're going to read the moves from the starting position. These are not setup positions. These are from the start. I'll try to go nice and slow. You can always go back and re-listen if you need to. And in the show notes, we will have a link to the position and then a link to the answer. So number one is, the game begins, e4, e5. White plays knight f3. Black plays knight f6. White plays knight takes pawn on e5. Black plays knight to c6. White plays knight takes knight on c6. Black plays d takes c6. White plays pawn to e5. Black plays knight to e4. White plays d3, ? Black plays bishop c5. Black takes the knight on e4. And now it is black to move and win. So I'll read the moves again, this time without commentary. e4, e5, knight f3, knight f6. Knight takes e5, knight c6. Knight takes c6, d takes c6. e5, knight e4, d3, bishop c5. White plays d takes e4. And it is black to move, and they have a sequence that forces a win. Number two, and by the way, that first puzzle I'd say is maybe 1400-1500 level, and this one will be a little bit harder, but not super hard if you stick with it. So we're back at the starting position. e4, e5, knight f3, knight f6. Knight takes e5, black plays knight c6, knight takes c6, d takes c6. White plays knight to c3, black plays bishop c5. White plays bishop c4, black plays knight to g4. White castles, Black plays queen to h4. White plays h3. Black plays knight takes f2. White plays queen f3. Black plays knight takes h3 check. White plays king to h1. And now black can force checkmate in not that many moves. I'm not going to say how many, but see if you can find a checkmate, a forced checkmate for black. And I'll repeat that whole thing. White plays e4. Black plays e5. White plays knight f3. Black plays knight f6. White plays knight takes pawn. Black plays knight c6. White plays knight takes knight on c6. Black plays d takes c6. White plays knight to c3. Black plays bishop c5. White plays bishop c4. Black plays knight g4. White castles. Black plays queen h4. White plays h3. Black plays knight takes f2. White plays queen to f3. Black plays knight takes h3 check. White plays king to h1. And now it is black to move and force checkmate. So those are your two Stafford Gambit puzzles. Let me know if you guys are still actually doing these blindfold puzzles. Maybe I'll try to do them slightly more often. But in any event, thanks for listening to Perpetual Chess, and we will catch you all soon. Thank you to everyone who listens to and supports the podcast. And most of all, thank you to my producer, Matthew Passy. Be sure to check us out on social media. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at BennyFishel1. We also have a Perpetual Chess Facebook group where we continue the conversation about each episode. I've even got the Instagram page locked and loaded, actually posting clips every week. So you can follow at Perpetual Chess to catch some clips there. I also want to thank our sponsors, of course, Chessable.com, the original sponsor of Perpetual Chess, Aim Chess, Chess Mood. Thanks. I'm proud to be affiliated with all of these sites. Also want to thank Blue Wire Podcast, with whom I partner. Big shout out to Blue Wire. Check them out for sports podcasts. But most of all, I want to thank the individuals who helped make Perpetual Chess go via PayPal or Patreon. And of course, they get to find out the guests, send in questions, hear occasional GM lectures on Zoom, and even get ad-free podcasts. So thank you all for supporting Perpetual Chess and keeping it going. So without further ado, I would like to give special thanks to the following people and entities. Chessable.com, David Lazarus of LazmanChess.com, Quality Chess Books, the Capital City Chess Club, the Abysmal Depths of Chess blog, shout out to JB, Adapta Interactive Web Designs and Services, the Apprentice Twitch channel, Aniti Deer, Austin Clough, Benjamin Porteau, Bill Sigler, Kathy Carr, Chad Oliver, the Charlotte Chess Center, the Chess Central's Chess Blog, Chessmood.com, Chris Flanagan, Chris Lott, Dan O'Hanlon, Daniel He, Danny Davidson, David Mitchell, I am Dimitri Schneider, Douglas Wilson, I am Eric Rosen, Farhan Thawar, Faraz Sawaf, Gary Foreman, Glenn Downing, Greg Harfst, Greg Shahadi, Gregory Gulick, Hampus Axelson, James Kennedy, Jay Garrison, Jeff Martinson, Jeff Schaefer, Jeremy Nilsson, John Jernigan, John Rockefeller, John MacArthur, Kevin Forsyth, Kevin Gilmore, Kevin O'Callaghan, Kevin Pryor, King's Celt, King's Crusher YouTube channel, the Law Offices of Stuart Katz, Matthew Feeney, Michael Kahn, FM Michael Oblin, Mr. Mike Shahadi, the famous Mr. Dodgy, the Nerdnace Twitch channel, Peter McManus, GM Peter Prohaska, Peter Soddy, Philip Vlummens, the Playmore Chess Academy of the Hamden Chess Club, Ray Lillywhite, Reuven Fisher, Robert Hansen, Ross Crossland, Seattle Chess Club, Shane Unger, Stefan Kelty, Stephen Martinez, Sven Gearson, Thomas Tachenko, Todd Bryant of StrongChess.com, Todd Kennedy, the Vintage Patsers, which is a Chess.com improver group, and Wayne Beam. I would also like to give thanks to East Viega, Adam Fowler, Adam Ralph of ChessEngland.com, Adrian Gutierrez, Al Hastings, Alan and Maggie Sue, Alex Pejas, Alexander Markovitz, Antonio Cancino, Antonio Leonfort, FM Andre Tarakov, Dr. Andrew Perry, Angus McLeod, Barry Hessian, Bill Juniper, Bill Moran, Bill Trammell, Brad and Andy Rosen, Brandon Halseed, Brian Chase, Brian Mullis, Bruce Scott, Brian Tillis of Palm Beach Chess, Cameron Davis, Ken Kabadai, Chad Hilton, Chad Likens of Rose City Chess in Portland, Oregon, Chess for Charity in Jacksonville, Chess Patzer Spain, Dr. Charles Snodgrass, Chris Kiefer, Chris Wainscott, Christopher Baumgartner, Christopher Chabrie, Christopher Wood. I am Christoph Zalecki, a.k.a. Chess Explained, Coach J's Chess Academy, Costa Caros, Courtney Fry, Craig Mallon, Daniel Ginsburg, Daniel Naylor, Dave Best, Dave Saylor, David Blaskotchek, David Brown, David Goris, David Hamblin, David Cramley, David Peterson, Dennis Parrish, FM, Donnie Ariel, Dwayne Edmonds, Ed Daly, Ed Mead, Edwin Rodriguez, Ethan Smith, Evan Rosenberg, Ewan Richardson, Ian Mason, Felipe Melo Perilla, Fox Valley Chess Club, Francis Letart Lavoie, Frank Tortoris, MD, Frank Zananis, Gary Andrews, Gary Lewis, Gautam Narula, Gene Stewart, George Foote, George Harris, Giovanni Russo, Gregory Higgins, Han Shute, Harish Srinivasan, Howard Vihan, Jacob Kovach, Jason Apollo, Jason Murray, Jacques Perry, James Aspinwall, James Bonastia, James Muir, Jason Willem, Jay Tuttle, J.D. Chakrabarty, Jeff Anderson, Jeffrey Martello, Yep Hoyland, Jerry Wells, Jesse DeCumus, excuse me, Jesse McNulty, Jim Ratliff, Jim Sadler, Joe DeSano, Joe Valdez, Thomas Ramos, John McAdams, John Tully, Juan Almaguer, Dr. John Fallon, John Fernandez, John Fontaine, John Hartman, John Jeffrey, John McMurtry, Jonathan Bannister, Jonathan Slater, John Quist, John Tully, Jose Rodriguez, Justin Gardner, Justin Goodfeller, Jen Chahadi, Joe Rocky, John Thompson, Grandmaster Josh Friedel, I am Kare Christensen, WGM Katerina Nemsova, Kelly Palmer, I am Kostya Kovutsky of Chess Dojo, Krishna Gopala Krishnan, Kyle McAvoy, Larry Cook, Larry Ryforth, Macaulay Peterson, Maria Emelyanova, a.k.a. Photo Chess, Mark Chaves, Mark Fitzpatrick, Mark Miller, Mark Wilkins, Marco Bulatovich, Martin Knudsen, Martin Krug, Matt Ferrari, Matthew Allen Coughlin, Matthew Tedesco of SeattleChessMeetup.org, Matthias Plock, the Mechanics Institute of San Francisco, Michael Ollard, Michael Hudson, Mike Clem, Mitchell Fabian, Nate Gobel, Nate Solon, Neil Bruce, Negmat Milijanov, Nicholas Isabel, Olaf Mueller-Michaels, Pablo Davila, Grandmaster Pascal Charbonneau, Passy Passanen, Paul Bain, Paul Clarkson, Paul Eckert, Paul Sweeney, Paulo Santana, Peter Lux, Queenside Management Limited of Switzerland, Randall Montgomery, Randy Temple, Ricky Grijalva, Richard Hollenbach, Richard Tucker, Robert Callahan, Robert Turner, Robert Wall, Robert Wilson, Rory Coleman, Ryan Berg, Samson Teaches Chess, Satyajit Malugu, The Say Chess Publishing, Unstoppable Empire, Scott McKinnon, Scott Rose, Sean Krause, Sebastian Finsterwalder, Sergey McCagan, Seth Ruzica, Seth Will, Sean Tracy, Silver Knights in Richmond, Simon Schmidt, Stefan Roller, Stephen Miller, and Tom George, WGM Tatya Vabrahamian, Terry King, Thomas Brown, Tim Brennan of TacticsTime.com, Tim Seymour, Timothy Ha, FM Timothy Wall, Tobiah Rex, Tom Edsel, Tommy Farron, Tony Rotella, Tyron Price, Victor Beauchamp, William Brock, William Peterson, FM Zhao Cheng of Chess1000.com, and last but never least, Zhivko Stoyanov. So thanks for listening, everyone. We will catch you all next week.
Podcast Network.